WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Colored farm workers enjoy Florida sunshine during the winter months. So reads a 1941 poster recruiting workers to cut sugarcane in the fields of Florida. The poster promised good wages, good living conditions, free transportation, and meals. But the people who went to work found the sugar company didn't deliver on its promises. The workers were charged for their transportation and tools and arrived at the camp already in debt. They were hunted down if they tried to escape. Complaints to the FBI resulted in a 1943 grand jury indictment charging the U.S. Sugar Corporation with conspiracy to commit slavery. Eventually, the indictment was dismissed on a technicality. But the next year, the industry shifted its recruitment efforts from Americans to West Indians. Journalist Alec Wilkinson updates the story in his new book, Big Sugar. Wilkinson is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine and spent 4 years researching his book. He focuses on what he calls the epic story of the workers, not on the growers and sugarcane lobby. I asked him what drew him to the story in the first place.
Well, I had heard that down in Florida, there were a collection of black men doing essentially what And not a small collection, but 10,000 black men doing what amounted to slave work, that they were migrant workers, and that it was supposed to be the most dangerous work in America and also the most difficult to do. And so I really just went down to take a look at that time for The New Yorker for a piece to see what was down there.
Now, I think you made initial contact through the Florida Sugarcane League, which is the lobby
right.
and PR group of the sugar industry in Florida. Were they cooperative?
They told me on my very first day there that I would... Actually, I hadn't even got there yet. It was over the telephone. Called them from New York, and they said the woman, who was otherwise quite pleasant, said that I would never meet a sugarcane cutter or visit a sugarcane camp. So they weren't the most generous of hosts in all areas, but they were welcoming in others.
When you tried to actually see sugarcane workers in the fields and then talk to them outside of their work, how did you get access?
Mainly over a long period of time. I mean, in the end, I finally met one person who introduced me to another and another and finally to quite a number, but it took a long time to meet the one. I tried all sorts of schemes to try and get myself into sugarcane camps, including impersonating a peddler, selling cigarettes and doing various other things that I thought would work, but none of which came to anything.
So how did you actually meet somebody?
I actually got an introduction to a guy who, an ex-convict was called Caveman. And Caveman would take me around to the camps, and we would visit, and I had a Polaroid camera also, and I had been told at the Florida Sugarcane League that one of the reasons that they would not be able to permit me to visit the cutters was that I had a camera and that the cutters abhorred having their picture taken. And it turned out that there's probably, so far as I could tell, few things in life they like more than having their pictures taken. And I would take their pictures and give them copies. And at a certain point, I just simply, after I'd got to know enough of them, said on one occasion, I was in a camp, and I was sitting down on a bed, and there were about 20 of them around me, and I put the camera down. And I said, it's time for you to tell me about sugarcane. And I reached over into my knapsack and take out my notebook to write down what they said. And I looked up, and there was one man standing there, and he was the man on whose bed I was sitting. And from him I met others.
Did people think you might be a spy for the industry?
I think they probably thought all kinds of things. It doesn't reflect all that well on my cunning, but it took me a long time to figure out that I thought the simple, I'm used as a reporter to simply dealing straightforwardly to people and saying, I'm doing a piece about, in this case, sugarcane cutting, can I ask you some questions? But naturally, there's so much intrigue around that and secrecy around that industry that probably made them think I was anything but who I said I was. So I had a lot of... Cutters have been warned by the growers and by the Sugarcane League, do not speak to reporters. And so it was very hard, and it was also from a moral point of view, difficult to talk to them because you had to get them away from the camp or somewhere in secret because I work by taking notes and writing down what people say and having a supervisor walk in on a cutter talking to a white guy writing down what he's saying is essentially presenting the cutter with his ticket back to his island.
Mm-hmm. You describe cutting sugarcane as the most perilous work in America. What makes it so dangerous?
More men are injured cutting sugarcane in America than at any other occupation in America, 40% of them. The next highest, according to OSHA standards, is 33%. So more injuries than in any other occupation.
Injured by the instrument that they used to cut the cane?
Mainly by the knife. A lot of very serious and permanently disabling back injuries, but most of it comes from the knife. Or second and third, or third and fourth, would probably be piercing your eardrum or your eye with a stalk.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what the living conditions are like in the camps for sugarcane workers?
Well, it's living. The largest camps are simply huge cement barracks, cement floors, and rows of bunk beds up and down the walls. Terrifically hot. This is South Florida. No provisions whatever made to cool the place down. All there are small little fans that the cutters buy in town from their wages and set up beside their heads to blow some air, but there are no fans in the dorms or that the company provides, and no air conditioning. And otherwise, they conform to square footage requirements set forth by the government, so they're, which is minimal.
So how many men are there per dorm?
It really depends on the camp. There are essentially two kinds of camps. One company has camps that are small cottages that jam about, 10 or 12 or 14 men into small little cottages, and then there are camps that have 2,000 or 1,400 men in the huge cement barrack warehouses, and then there are also smaller versions of those where you'll find maybe 200 or 150 or 80.
You've painted a pretty grim picture about what it's like to work in the sugar fields of Florida. You've spoken to many West Indians who work there. What's a couple of the reasons that you heard directly from the men who work in the fields about why, for the moment, they're choosing that life?
Well, they don't have a choice. They aren't choosing it. As I put in my book, I said if there were any other possibility for them to work at home, it's clear they would never cut sugarcane. To live in Jamaica and Kingston is a very, in terms of financial circumstances, a very grim life. These people have no other choice but to do whatever they can do to get some work. And this at least offers the possibility of 6 months of work, which is a kind of unexampled piece of good fortune in Jamaica.
There been any attempts to unionize?
There hasn't been, that I know of, an attempt to actually unionize the cutters, because labor difficulties of any seriousness or intensity, the cutters solve by shipping home any of the cutters, hundreds at a time. In 1972, there was a strike at one of the companies involving Cuban tractor drivers that never really got, that was supported by the United Farm Workers Union, but never really got to involve the West Indians, and they don't really, there's no real way to get a toehold.
I wonder what effect you think that recent press on working conditions in the sugarcane fields, what effect that's going to have on working conditions there. For instance, there's your book, Big Sugar. Mm-hmm. There was recently a feature on West 57th mm-hmm. about working conditions there. You think that's going to have any effect?
Let's say I hope so. One doesn't know. I think that this business has operated in great secrecy for many years. It's a 19th century industry. In addition, of course, to simply the conditions of the field and what happens, they also receive this migrant worker program amounts to them in another form as another kind of government subsidy. These workers have no choice over what grower they'll work for, what farm they'll be assigned to. They're simply, it's like joining the army. You sign up and you're shipped out and you go where you're sent. This means that the growers never have to compete with each other for wage prices. It's a monopoly. So they've had a lot of reason to keep this terrifically secret. My book now is the first time that anybody has managed to get as much information over as long a period of time about the sugar business, and I would hope that when this kind of information gets out to other people, that this is a kind of thing that would not be kind of business practices that shouldn't be tolerated in America. I don't think it doesn't, I'm not in sympathy with the idea that the family that owns the two largest sugar corporations should be worth $500 million. The complaint is always made by the growers that they can't afford to pay more money for the harvest, but logical extension of that argument is that, do you mean to tell me that this family might, if they were forced to pay more for their harvest, might only be worth $498 million? $496? I mean, would that really be, is that really the side that one feels comfortable supporting? And I don't, and I certainly hope that something is done. This is a terrible, dreadful life that these men lead, full of lots of full of suffering, and I find it distasteful that it leads to, on the other end of the spectrum, lives of unexampled prosperity.
Well, Alec Wilkinson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.